Jonathan Nkala is one of the millions of Zimbabwean refugees who left his family behind and is now living in South Africa. Jonathan had to walk and hitchhike for hundreds of miles. He had very little money and he hadn't eaten for days. He still remembers the first time he saw the capital city, Johannesburg.
Oh, it was like, wow. Very big buildings, a lot of people, beautiful people wearing expensive clothes, watches, DVDs, and thing that I still remember is the full chicken, you know, the whole chicken. I'd never ate the whole chicken in my life, and I just ate it all. Like, wow, it was something.
Jonathan says the next thing he did was cry for the childhood companion who had set out with him and who had not survived the treacherous crossing of the Limpopo River. Their journey underlines the desperation of people trying to leave Zimbabwe, even today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The latest news from South Africa is that Zimbabwean refugees are now facing a new threat. They are being attacked in the major cities like Cape Town and Durban and Johannesburg. Gangs of unemployed South Africans are beating the refugees, burning their homes, and telling them they are no longer welcome in South Africa.
It's just most of them, they just have to go back to their country and leave us in peace.
But they can't go back. There are 3 million Zimbabweans here.
But there's the only solution. They just have to go back to their country. Or if not, so they're going to get killed. As you can see at the moment, look at how many sheikhs have been burned down.
Jonathan Nkala came to South Africa as a refugee. He's actually started to make a good living as an entertainer, but for the past week, even he's been afraid to leave his home. He says it's just too dangerous to be a Zimbabwean on the streets. Jonathan is still glad he made the trip to South Africa, but he wouldn't recommend it today.
Number one, I will never ever allow someone to come the way I did. I will never, to be honest. I will never ever do that thing, and I will never allow anyone to do the way I did. I'll let my brother do it, never let my sister, my mom, whoever. For me, it's like I don't even believe that I'm still alive.
Jonathan Nkala's long journey to South Africa began years ago in a small village in Zimbabwe. He and his best friend Jacob were musicians, and they got to dreaming maybe their real future was on a stage in South Africa.
We used to make our small little guitars with oil cans, you know, the oil cans and a little bit of wood, and make our drums with some old cans and dusty bins, make some music. But then it was very difficult for us, like, to get some instruments in Zimbabwe or get our voice heard there. I had no chance to show off my talents. When we finished school, that is when the thing became very, very serious. Things were going down in Zimbabwe. No works, no jobs, and too much violence and all this stuff. And we believed in entertaining people, making people happy. And so we couldn't find that thing in there. So the only place we could go, maybe South Africa, try something better.
On the day when Jacob said, it's time we left, let's go to South Africa, did you leave on that day, or was that just the beginning of a plan?
Actually, on the day that we said, now is the time, it was the day after we had about 3 to 4 days without eating. Sometimes I could go eat at Jacob's place if they had food. Then he could come eat my place when we had food. But that time, me and Jacob had finished school and there was no food at their place. There was no food at our place. So that means we couldn't do anything for about 4 to 5 days. And they said, no, this is the time now. We have to go.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about the food shortages that you guys were experiencing in Zimbabwe? When you say there was nothing to eat, do you mean really nothing at all?
I mean nothing from sugar, salt, millimil, nothing. Nothing.
And Jonathan, is that because there was nothing available or because you couldn't afford it? What was the reason behind that?
Number one, we couldn't afford it. And number two, there was nothing in the shops as well.
Was there anything that you could eat when you couldn't get food from the shops?
apart from mangoes and peaches from the trees, there was nothing. If you can check, when it comes to 2000, 2001, 2002, we had a drought in Zimbabwe. So all the trees, I'm talking about the mangoes and stuff like, they were all dead. So there was nothing. You know, it is very painful to see your parents. It's better if I'm hungry, but to see your parents, your mother is sitting there, she's very, very hungry, and you know, mothers, they normally cry. They're crying for you. And I'm crying for her as well. So it's a very, very painful experience. You don't want to be in that experience.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Around the time that Jonathan and Jacob chose to leave, inflation had turned the Zimbabwe dollar into near worthless paper. The two of them were near starving. There was no point staying. But Jonathan and Kala says they had to be careful when they left. They decided that they'd leave early one morning and tell no one.
Of course, me and Jacob, we used to go out to the bush and get some firewood and sell it around. And people used to, they use firewood for cooking and, you know, for all that stuff. You know, in Zimbabwe, you can sell toilet paper, especially nowadays, for $1 million just for a toilet paper. So we actually had some few millions, me and him. And we just said, this is enough. We didn't tell nobody knew about it. We just left home with our exes, like we're going to the bush to fetch some wood. That was it. And what happened to the exes, I don't know, because we just threw them somewhere there. I wish I could go there and find them again, but I'm not sure. So we actually eventually found a truck that was transporting cotton from Gokwe to Beitbridge. Beitbridge is the border gate from Zimbabwe to South Africa. And the driver did give us a lift. So there we were. We were in Beitbridge.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute, Jonathan? Why did you have to leave in secret? Why couldn't you even say goodbye to your mother?
The thing is, because we were going to border jump, we couldn't afford getting passports and getting a visa, just a visa from Zimbabwe to South Africa. It cost a lot of money, and we could not afford, we will never afford it. And then in case of border jumping, before you come to South Africa, if you're in Zimbabwe, there's a river called the Limpopo River. There are a lot of crocodiles and hippos, and the river itself is very wide and narrow, so a lot of people have perished there. And every day on news, you could see so many hundreds, so many tens of people have died there. And they are soldiers. Sometimes they do shoot you and stuff. You can't tell your parents that I'm going through that thing. And as a mother or as a father, they'll just know exactly what is going to happen to my child. So you rather live in secret. If it happens to you, they mustn't know it. They just said you disappeared. And So that's why we did that. We didn't want to make them feel guilty that they let us go. It's up to us. So that's why we didn't tell anyone.
So here you are in Beitbridge. How do you get across the Limpopo River?
Crossing the border at the Limpopo River is very, very difficult. There's razor wire. It's also electrified. There are soldiers from both borders, from Zimbabwe and South Africa. It's very, very difficult. When you go, even today, if you go to Beitbridge today, you'll see thousands and thousands of people loitering around. But we were very, very lucky because me and Jacob, we had something in common, like we can talk to people, go to people, ask and see what we can use, you know. And we actually found some people who were working in farms in South Africa. And those guys there, they know a place where they could cross. You have to walk for a couple of days to get there because there's no road. You just walk through the bush. And then when you get there, there's no much razor wire and electric fence, and there are no soldiers and police patrolling there. We took about 8 to 9 days walking to that place.
So it was a long way away from Beitbridge.
It's a long way.
Jonathan, what did the river look like when you got there? Once you got to a place where there was no razor wire and there was no electric fence, how big was the river?
The truth is, I was not expecting what I saw there. You could not tell that the river is flowing. From outside, it was like still. But then we could see that this river is it's wide and it's so deep. And the other thing is, you can see crocodiles. There are crocodiles and there are hippos. Those things, you can see them. Even before you get to the river, before you get to the river, you can see crocodiles walking around, you know, just around the thing. And you can see that there's no way that someone can say, let me cross there. But because we were so determined, we really needed something, we had something that we have planned for years. And so there were some guys, they earn their money by helping people cross. That's what they do. So we had to pay those guys in order for them to help us. And because we had no money, so we had to pay them with our clothes, like shoes.
You had to give them your pay with your shoes because you didn't have the money.
Yeah.
Jonathan and Kala made it across the river. His best friend, Jacob, did not survive the crossing. In just a moment, I'll talk with Jonathan about how that happened and how he made his way on to Johannesburg, barefoot, after that. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In recent days, there's been a rash of violent attacks on immigrants in South Africa. Most of the people being targeted are unregistered immigrant families from Zimbabwe, people who fled the hunger and unemployment at home for a better life in South Africa. Jonathan Nkala's story underlines the tremendous risk that most people face when they try to cross that border illegally. Jonathan and his friend Jacob were born in Zimbabwe, and about 6 years ago, they hitched a ride to the border and hiked along the banks of the Limpopo River looking for a place to cross. They met some guys who said they could help them, even though they didn't have a boat.
They took a very, very big tree trunk, a dry one, that doesn't drown.
Yeah,
a very big tree trunk that doesn't drown. And they put a piece of wire on one end and another one on the other end. So what happens there is the one guy will go on the first end there. That piece of wire there, you'll use it for controlling. And then the other guy will also go at the back. And then we, the passengers, with our left hands, slightly hold it. And then pedal with our right hands.
So this tree trunk is big enough so you can actually sit on top of it. Is that right?
No, you don't sit on it. You just hold with your hand.
Your body's in the water, but you're holding the log with
your
hand.
Your body's in the water. Yes. So you just hold it so that you don't sink.
Man. And so the guy on the front is pulling the wire, so he brings you across
the
river.
He's pulling the wire.
And the guy on the back is letting the wire out, so you move across the river.
So what's happening is, because the river is flowing, it's flowing like nobody's business, it will flow with the trunk. So these guys now will be pulling the trunk with using the wire against the flow.
I understand, yeah.
So the other guy will be pulling this side, the other guy pulling that side against the flow. And then we're pedaling, going across.
What's the distance across the river?
I would say we spend about 1.5 hours, because the thing is, the river is flowing, so they really cannot resist it So sometimes they let it go and then pull it again, let it go. So it was around 1.5 hours or so, yes.
So you're in the Limpopo River. Your body's in the Limpopo River for that length of time, and there's crocodiles and there's hippos there.
Yep.
And how about holding on to the log? Does it stay steady or does it move as well?
The log is moving, but then you just follow the log. Wherever it goes, you follow the log. And those guys will be screaming, now follow, a little bit resist. And unfortunately, maybe if I may say it, my friend Jacob, the one who actually initiated our move, I lost him in there. We lost two people in there.
What happened?
You see, when you're walking there, when the river is flowing, there are a lot of twigs and logs that are being flown by the river. And so sometimes they can hit your feet and you can lose it. So he was one of them and he couldn't hold on to the log. And the thing is, on the log, you're supposed to slightly hold it. You cannot actually grab it. Because the moment you grab it, those guys will be screaming at you. Because when you grab it, the log will go down and everyone will go. So it was a matter of just holding slightly and hoping for the best.
How many people were holding on to the log?
We were about 8, 9, or 10.
And where were you? Were you at the front or at the back?
Hey, the thing, I'm very tall, so I was told to be at the back.
So you could see
the
other
people
in front of
you? So it was like shorter and... Yeah, I could see other people in front of me.
And you saw people having a hard time holding on?
I saw two people going away, yes. And I saw him going away as well.
Jacob?
Yeah.
Did he call to you? Did you call to him?
It was very, very difficult because, you know, at that moment, I wasn't even sure of myself. Because, number one, I until today, I can't swim. And I don't want to try because of that experience there. I will never, ever try. Because whenever I go into water, then that memory comes back to me and it's something that I can't do.
Could Jacob swim?
Yep, he could. By that moment, he couldn't do anything. There were moments that I actually thought that it's over with me. So, I can't blame him, but it's one of those things.
So what was it like to get there? You and Jacob had planned this for years. You get to the other side of the river finally. He has not made it. You're there by yourself. What are you thinking? That you'll go on? That it's not worth going on? What are you thinking?
Actually, I cried like... I don't cry. You know, I don't cry. Because I'm used in everything. I don't normally cry. But that was my first time of like really, really crying. You know, even if my father passed away, I didn't cry. I've lost a lot of family members. But that one was more like it was my first time, and after my crying, it was like, no, let me just go forward. If I go back home, I won't achieve what me and Jacob have planned. We will never do the music that we have planned, and it will be like, I was just there to let Jacob go, and well, I was not there to let Jacob go. We had plans and we stuck to them, so I had to go on.
When Jonathan Nkala found himself on the other side of the river, he knew that he'd made it. He was in South Africa, but he had nothing. His friend Jacob was gone. Jonathan had no money, no shoes. He'd traded those for his trip across the river. Jonathan saw an opportunity to work at a nearby tomato farm.
There's always work there. You get there, you work. So I worked there for a week, starting from 7 in the morning until sunset. I've never worked that hard. I really, really worked very hard.
What kind of farm was it?
It's a tomato farm.
Uh-huh.
And after a week, I asked the foreman to release me so that I can go ahead. Because our aim, me and Jacob, was to go to Joburg, Johannesburg. So he gave me 30 rands.
That's like a dollar, yeah. Isn't it?
I think so, yeah. 30 rands is like a dollar.
For a week's work. Okay.
For a week's work. Yes. So welcome. I couldn't even believe myself.
I was going to say, welcome to South Africa.
Yeah, but at least I had earned something.
Yeah.
I had earned something. It wasn't bad for me. I'd earned something and trying to get some lifts now from the farm to Joburg was like a nightmare. And there were a lot of trucks which transported tomatoes from the farm to Joburg. But then they needed 100 rands or 150, and I had 30. And the thing with me is I don't give up. When I really need something, that's one thing that I always do. I don't give up. I go for it until I get it.
So what did you do?
I kept on trying until I saw this other truck driver, a little bit old. He just bought himself a brand new cell phone, brand new one. It's in the box and there's the manual in there. But the problem is he cannot actually activate it. So he's busy trying to activate the cell phone and stuff, and then he can't. And he's like just trying pressing it and stuff, like it was not working. So I went there. One thing I knew is whenever there's something brand new, there's a manual there. And apparently I can read and I can speak. So I just offered to help. And he said, okay, can you do it for me? No, I can do it for you. And then I said, bring that book here. That's the manual. I'm reading carefully. And that time my mind is telling me, I have to read this thing and I have to do this thing for this man and this thing must work. And if this thing works, this man is going to do me a favor. He's going to give me a lift. And that's what I did. Took my time, read the thing. It was in English. I can read English. I can speak English. I read it and in no time, we are calling Hello Moto. And the man was very, very impressed. And he was like, can I give you something? No, you don't have to give me any money, man. Just give me a lift. So that's how it happened. He gave me the lift.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Jonathan Nkala had survived the dangerous crossing from Zimbabwe to South Africa. At this point in his journey, he had a ride. He was heading towards Johannesburg. And then the truck driver with the cell phone left Jonathan to make a delivery, told him he'd be right back.
So he asked me to wait for him until he comes and told me to stay away from the public because there are a lot of police there patrolling, looking for people like us. So I have to hide, wait for him, wait for the truck. I knew the truck and I waited until in the morning, but I don't know what happened to him. Maybe he ran away from me. I'm not sure, but I never saw him. So when it was in the morning, I just thought, oh my God, why can I not just keep on walking? Otherwise, I'm going to get caught here before I go to where I want. So I just walked parallel to the main road, but in the bush. Just kept on walking. One day, 2 days. On the third day, I met some people. I had a baby crying somewhere, and I met a woman and two men. That woman had a very small baby, and they were also walking parallel to the main road in the bush as well.
These are also Zimbabweans who have.
They're also Zimbabweans, yeah.
And how much risk are you guys at this point? I mean, if you walked on the road, would you be picked up and deported back to Zimbabwe or put in jail? What was the risk?
You're going to be picked up and then deported back to Zimbabwe. It means I'll start again from those 8 days and crossing the river and then going to the farm again. So it wasn't worth it. So I'd rather go walk in the bush.
How long before you got to Joburg?
It wasn't long, because when I met those people there, the baby was crying too much. Probably she was hungry and thirsty. And so the mother actually decided to go into the street and ask for help, because we've walked a long way from the border post. Well, it wasn't easy for us to let her do that. We had to fight here, but eventually she couldn't take it anymore. So she went to the street and she started hiking, and then she got a truck, and then when we had a truck stop, we all hid in the bushes thinking they were the police. And but then it was not the police. And then she spoke to them and told them that she had company, and they brought us. And the driver also said, oh, he welcomed us and he gave us a lift. And he left us in Jamestown, a place called Jamestown. Well, I don't know how did I go from there, because I was sleeping from 4 or 5 days not sleeping. And he gave us money to get a train from Jamestown to Johannesburg. And then we parted our ways there. I never saw them again. Even today, I don't know them. I've never seen them.
Do you remember what your first impressions were of Johannesburg when you stepped off the train?
Oh, it was like, wow. Very big buildings, a lot of people, beautiful people wearing expensive clothes, watches, DVDs, and food places. They're selling, you know, the thing that I still remember is the full chicken, you know, the whole chicken was 11 rands, and that guy gave me about 15 rands, and I'd never ate the full, the whole chicken in my life, and I just ate it all. You know, it was like, wow, it was something exciting. Yeah, and it was something big. The first thing that I did was crying, thinking that if my friend Jacob, we have been planning to get, and he's the one who actually initiated the thing, and there I am in Joburg, and he's not there, and my family at home, they don't even know where I am. So it was something that made me, like, you know, cry as well. So it,
to have this without Jacob then was...
Especially without Jacob. You know, yeah. It was going to be much better if I had Jacob, but, well, there's nothing I could do as well.
Where did you stay?
In the park.
Just slept outside?
Yeah.
And could you get
for
work?
About 3 months.
3 months in the park?
Yeah.
Huh.
I was trying every day. Every day I was going around asking for work in the gardens. But the way I was looking, I couldn't go ask for work anywhere in the office. They'll call the cops for me.
Why? Because you just had a pair of
no
shorts.
No shoes. A pair of shorts. And you are taking a shower in the public toilet. So you don't miss going up into the offices like that.
You weren't looking your best at the time then, Jonathan.
No.
How did you finally get a job then?
Eventually, when I was very, very tired, I was actually, at this moment, I was not looking for a job. I had given up, to be honest. I actually gave up. I was actually looking for at least 100 trains to go back home. Because it was much better at home than I was in here. But at home, at least I would sleep in the house. But here it was like... So the only thing that I wanted was, at least if I can get 100 trains, go back home and say, well, I've tried my best.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Jonathan and Calla finally got a break. He met a local real estate agent named Margaret. She asked him to do some work to put some manure on her garden.
She promised to give me 80 rands a day before 3 days. So when I went in there, I could see that this thing I can do it for 30 minutes. So before lunch, I had already finished putting the manure in the garden. But I wanted to impress. That's what I really wanted to do. So when she came back for lunch, I was starting weeding, you know, in the garden, and she was like, oh my God, you bugger. What the hell are you doing? You're supposed to work for 3 days so that I can give you an alarm. But now you work for 30 minutes, I'll only give you 40 rands. And that's when it came to me. I'm like, oh my God, what have I done?
You should have taken
But she,
your time.
She understood. She understood my situation, and she gave me 500 rands.
500?
And she, uh-huh. 500, yes. And she gave me some shoes. And I had a very, very lovely shower that I'll never forget. And perfume. And I felt like, like I was in Hollywood.
How long had it been since you had had a real shower at that time?
3 months.
One thing I'm curious about, Jonathan, with all the Zimbabwean refugees who are in South Africa and all of them looking for work like you, did Margaret ever say why she picked you to do some work for her, why she gave you that break?
No, she never said that. I don't know. You just gave me a question that I have to go ask you. I never thought of asking you. Thank you very much.
Margaret did more for Jonathan and Kala than give him a job tending her garden. She ended up helping him through college. And at some point he told her about the real dream that had propelled him to South Africa in the first place. It was to be an entertainer, to perform, to play music, to get up on a stage. He succeeded in that too in the way he least expected. He became the voice and the face of the South African Motorola cell phone. His signature line, "Hello, Moto." I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Jonathan Nkala is one of the estimated 3 million Zimbabweans living in South Africa. Most of them are there illegally. Jonathan barely survived his crossing of the border, and he had a hard time making money early on in South Africa. Lately, though, Jonathan's had a lot more success. He started out by going to the beach in Cape Town, twisting up those little wire figurines and then charming people into buying them. I asked him to give me his line.
How much do you have? Okay, the things I come to you and say, good evening or good afternoon, good people, how are you? I'm very well. I'm Jonathan Kumbulani. They do call me Kumbu on stage. I mean, people are laughing in here.
That's okay. They're laughing here too. Go for it.
So I met some people. They were directors. They were in South Africa to shoot the Motorola commercial. And so when I did that thing, they were like, oh my God, you're supposed to be on stage or on TV. Eventually, they called me for castings. I went for the castings and I got the job.
As an actor?
TV.
In a Motorola commercial?
As an actor. In a Motorola commercial. I'm on TV and I'm on stills. And I went on. I've done quite a few commercials now. I've done maybe 6-7 commercials. And even tomorrow morning, I'm going for a shoot.
What did you do in the Motorola commercial that caught people's attention?
They were introducing a very brand new Motorola cell phone. So what I was doing is, I'm in the street tap, I sell food there, and then I'm juggling with tomatoes and onions. Like I'm cutting onions and tomatoes very, very fast, like a professional chef. And people are gathering, you know, in the street, and they imagine seeing a professional chef cutting in the street.
Yeah.
And I'm juggling 6-7 tomatoes at the time, and I'm juggling 8 knives at the same time. And then the thing will go like, wait until you see the new Motorola cell phone. And for the first time, I was on radio saying, hello, Moto. I couldn't believe it. And was on newspapers and TV. I've also done some movies.
You got
famous. I also do some plays. No, I'm not famous yet, but I think I will be.
Along the way, and with the help of people he met in South Africa, Jonathan and Kala got the papers he needed to live there legally. And that gave him the opportunity to go back home to Zimbabwe. Now remember, earlier Jonathan told me that when he and his best friend Jacob left, they told no one where they were going. And years had passed since his friend Jacob had drowned in the river on their way out of Zimbabwe. So Jonathan was going home to deliver that news.
It was very, very painful and exciting at the same time because I had to go and pass the bad news about Jacob. Because nobody knew, even my parents, when they saw me, you can't believe. Like we spent maybe 3 hours of not talking to each other, just tears. And I had to talk about Jacob, what happened to him and all these things. So it was fun and it was not fun at all as well. So... But I'm very, very lucky because Jacob's parents, they really, really understood. You know, sometimes I feel guilty, but I'm happy because they understood.
I mean, what was it like for you to go from your success in South Africa back to Zimbabwe, which was still having such difficult times then?
I don't know what to say, but our aim was to make music. So at the moment, that's what I'm busy working on now. Yep. So I cannot raise my hand and say I'm successful. I'm not successful yet.
And the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, Jonathan, is what's it like being a Zimbabwean in South Africa? Now, I realize that you got your asylum seeker's paper, so you're legal there, but is it still, are there times when it's difficult for you not being a native South African?
It's just like being in Zimbabwe. It's sometimes it's horrible, sometimes it's very good. But I will say to you, I'm very, very lucky. I don't know. I'm a very lucky guy because I've met a lot of good people in my way. I sometimes wonder why. I've met a lot of very good people. Maybe because I struggled and suffered a lot in my time. But for now, I'm meeting good people.
So here's a question for you. When you go back to Zimbabwe, people that you would know, they look at you and they see Jonathan's got these good new clothes on and new shoes, and he's obviously made something of himself in South Africa. And so they say to you, hey, Jonathan, we should all go to South Africa and, you know, in the way that you did. What do you tell them? What kind of advice do you give to the people in Zimbabwe?
Number one, I will never, ever allow someone to come the way I did. I will never, to be honest.
Unless I don't like that person.
I will never let my brother do it, never let my sister, my mom, whoever, anyone that I know, because I know what is it like. And for me, it's like I don't even believe that I'm still alive. Whoever wants to come is free to come, not the way I did. Very bad.
And how about you? You were saying to me that you still have a fear of water after your experience in the river. How are you doing?
The only fear that I have at the moment is to fail. Only. I don't want to fail. That's all.
To fail at what?
Failing at whatever I put my mind to. I'll work very hard to achieve whatever I want to achieve. Yeah.
Like you have something to
and
prove.
And I believe... No, I don't have anything to prove to anyone. I don't have anything to prove. I just want to achieve what I've put my mind to. Only.
You still think about Jacob?
Every day. He's like an inspiration to me.
Jonathan Nkala says this song, Kumbulani, tells the story of the journey that he and Jacob shared in their flight from Zimbabwe. Jonathan now lives in Cape Town. I should say thanks to the South African Broadcasting Corporation and to our colleague Beverly Abel for their help in pulling this interview together. We have some pictures on our website at thestory.org, pictures of those little wire figurines that Jonathan was peddling on the beach. The Democratic primary race, the long Democratic primary race, is back in the news. Senator Hillary Clinton has racked up a win in Kentucky, and Senator Barack Obama won the contest in Oregon. I've been talking during this election season about the moment that you might recall when politics took on real meaning for you. Frank Lynch quite clearly remembers the moment that changed everything for him. Frank knew that he'd be eligible to vote in the early 1970s, and he was waiting till he was old enough. So when the Constitution was amended to allow 18-year-olds to vote, Frank was eager to get his fellow college students involved.
You could show up at the supervisor of elections office at a particular date and time and be deputized to be a voter registrar. We had over 100 people show up. And most of the people working in the supervisor of elections office were middle-aged ladies and just never seen something quite like this.
Well, what did they see? Describe the scene for me, yeah.
A lot of long hairs, a lot of strange and weird people. And a little to my chagrin, I also smelled just a whiff of marijuana smoke.
You mean in the office you could pick up the scent of pot?
Yeah.
And you're thinking to yourself what at this point, Frank?
Oh, no. Not now.
That was Frank Lynch in Tallahassee. My guest today is Kevin Killer. Kevin is a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe. He lives on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Now, that's an area with some pretty high rates of poverty and unemployment. And a lot of the people who live there aren't particularly enchanted by politics. They don't see it as having much effect on their lives. But Kevin remembers that his grandmothers understood well the power of politics.
Actually, my grandma, she was really, she did a lot, you know, for Pine Ridge and stuff like that. And she decided to kind of advocate on behalf of the American Indian movement. And, you know, she used to talk to other people all over. And she would just make sure that, you know, people had their rights stood up for, in a sense. And she got a lot of respect from that, you know, from the community. Her and my grandma Geraldine Janice and grandma Evelyn Dion, they really, you know, they did a lot. And they were really humble about it, so you don't hear too much.
Even with that kind of history, Kevin Killer's father wanted to make sure that his son saw more than just life on the reservation.
I grew up in Denver, and I went to school there. And my dad, well, he lived on the reservation, and he made sure that we had a better chance to kind of progress in mainstream society. And he felt it was important that we grew up in a city. But he always emphasized to us that we come back to the reservation and stuff like that. And he used to bring us back during the summers and used to introduce us to our relatives and make sure we knew them. And we did sweats and Sundances and stuff like that. So we kind of familiarized ourselves with the culture and made sure we weren't too far removed from that. So
I can imagine, though, if you're a teenager living in Denver,
you're sort of saying,
well, let's see, Denver or Pine Ridge, you must have been a little bit more taken by the city at that time.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, growing up in Denver, you go back to Pine Ridge and stuff's a little bit slower. And certainly it's a pace that you have to get used to. And just being there for like a couple of weeks out of the year, you know, it was like, well, you know. So, and I really got to know people in the community and stuff. And, you know, they remember me. So like when I came back later on, it's like, you know, we had kind of like a little close-knit community there.
What was it that brought you back to Pine Ridge to live, though?
Well, my dad, he passed away when I was 20 years old, I think. And he was a CPA. He was the only Oglala Lakota CPA to date that I know of. And he was one of six Native American CPAs at the time. And, you know, he had his own business. And his business philosophy was basically just to help Native tribes, organizations, and people in government. And, you know, I always emphasized to us that we help others, and growing up in that environment and seeing that, and really left an impression on me. So when he passed away, I was just felt kind of compelled to try to do more in Pine Ridge and for our own tribe, for my tribe in a sense. And that's what kind of led me back.
So after Kevin Killer's father died, Kevin moved home and took an entry-level job with the tribe. He found his way into politics and was soon going door to door trying to convince people to vote. And that's when he heard firsthand about the disenchantment people were feeling.
You begin to hear people's stories about, you know, why they don't want to vote. And they had a lot of distrust of the government just because Pine Ridge is one of the poorest places in the United States. And just to see that and understand that at that age, just really being able to get out there and listen to people's issues, and you begin to think that, okay, well, you know, change is possible and you want to do something about it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The turning point for Kevin came during the election in 2004. Once again, he found himself convincing people to vote. But that's when he saw the kind of electoral rules that they were up against.
I was assigned to a parking lot in a supermarket store right by the polling station, and just coming up to people in cars and making sure they knew about their voting rights and their voting record, and, you know, this is what you have to have at the ID. I'd talk to people like about 5 minutes, and then they'd go drive over to the polling station, and then they'd come out like a minute later. And you know, I was thinking, I was like, well, that's kind of odd. Then I'd see another person do that. And I asked somebody what happened, and he told me that, well, you know, they said they didn't have my record on there. And I was like, well, did you vote in 2002? And I was like, okay, yeah, I did vote. So you should be registered. So I walked in there with him, and they said, okay, well, you're not on here. And I was like, well, you need to offer this particular individual a provisional ballot. They did get it, but I seen others get turned away that didn't come back. And that's what was really frustrating, because you'd barely convince somebody to vote. And then you'd see them leave like a minute later, and just to have them turned off by that one experience, it was frustrating in a sense. And
did you talk to the people who were running the poll, Kevin? Did you say, you know, what's wrong with this person's ID? Why aren't you letting these people vote?
I was almost yelling at them in a sense. Well, you need to let these people vote, or you need to offer them a provisional ballot, because according to state law, it says that, you know, if they don't have an ID, you know, you need to offer them an affidavit in lieu of an ID.
Well, what did they say when you told them?
Well, they were just kind of shocked that somebody would tell them that. And so I had to sit there from 12 o'clock to almost 4 o'clock that day just to make sure that everybody that had the right to vote needed to vote. So
did you take people through those lines one at a time, or did you just watch them as they went in? What did you end up doing?
Yeah, I just ended up watching them. But they kind of understood that, you know, I was sitting behind them making sure that that wouldn't happen again. And it was frustrating to see that to your own people and understand that, you know, what we all go through, you know, just as natives and the stereotypes and things like that. And when we're trying to, you know, empower ourselves politically and we come to these roadblocks, it's really frustrating and a little bit humiliating for people. And you understand that, you know, because you've been through that yourself.
Now, most of the people in Pine Ridge are Oglala Lakota. They're native, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the people running the poll, are they also native?
At the time, it wasn't, yeah. I think the county auditor hired them.
So there were white people running the poll?
Yeah.
Did it look to you like it was political gamesmanship, or did it look to you like it was some kind of discrimination going on?
I think it was more or less just misinterpretation of the rules, but it could be a little bit a game of political gamesmanship. But at the same time, I want to believe that it was just a misinterpretation of the rules.
Was there any one person or any?
Yeah, I remember that I was canvassing in the parking lot, and I just happened to come upon a car. This elderly gentleman was waiting for his wife to come out of the store, and I just walked up, you know, just casually and said, okay, well, do you know about voting? And he's like, no. And I was like, okay, well, this is how it affects our sovereignty, our community in a sense. And he was like, okay, well, tell me what I need to do. And I was like, well, you know, they're voting over there today, and if you can just go over there, there shouldn't be no problems. And so they head over to the polling station. I watch them go over there, and again, like a minute later, they come walking out. It's like, well, you can't vote that fast, you know. So, and he is just like, well, like they said my name wasn't on the poll. And you know, I was kind of like stunned, because you know, he looked kind of hurt, and I was like, well, we need to make sure that your name's on there. We need to make sure you go back in there and vote. I'll go in there with you if you want. And he was like, no, I'll just do it some other time. And, you know, and right there, that's where I kind of like experienced. I was like, man, you know, this is real frustration and this is real hurt. And you think about somebody that old that went through everything in life and you barely convince them to vote, you know, and to get turned away like that.
This guy never did go back to vote then?
Yeah, he never did go back to vote. That one moment really stuck with me, partly my motivation to kind of help out with voting rights and things like that, making sure, you know, all our people have the right to vote.
You saw this guy as being, I don't know what, insulted?
Yeah, I mean, well, mostly hurt. Well, insulted and hurt, I guess, in a sense. And really, in our community, you don't, you know, treat elders like that.
Kevin Killer lives on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. In fact, he's running for a seat in the state legislature there this fall. How about you? A moment from your past when you saw that politics caught your imagination? I mean, for my money, what's missing are the personal stories about those moments that make a difference in your life. For some people, it's the first time they voted. For others, it's one of those unexpected encounters with politics or a politician, something that really does make a difference. If you've got something to talk about, go to our website at thestory.org, leave me a couple of lines there, or call and leave a message on our phone at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We'll be right back.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.